Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, the essential podcast for middle market business owners, key stakeholders, and the advisors who guide them. I'm Josh Pottinger and joined by my co-host, Jason Chirogiannis. Together, we lead ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team at UBS here in Austin, Texas. Now, over the course of almost 30 years, we've built a vibrant community and have curated a suite of resources tailored for your success, from insightful white papers and cutting-edge research to exclusive in-person events and expert-led podcasts. We are here to provide the tools that you need. Now, if you're considering an exit, this is likely the most significant financial decision of your life, and typically, you only have one chance to get it right. So our mission is clear: to arm you with the knowledge to enhance the value of your business, navigate a successful sale, and of course, optimize your post-exit financial outcomes. Now with that, let's dive in and unlock the strategies that will prepare you for a prosperous future. Okay, let's get started with episode number 36 of the Lightning in a Bottle podcast. My name is Josh Pottinger. Jason is out today. His wife's birthday is today, so he's a smart man spending time with his wife Adina. So it's just Josh and Greg today. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yep. So Greg Sidor is joining me today, and we have a fun conversation all about private aviation. So in our experience working with founders that have had significant liquidity events, they start to kind of think about private aviation. So they ask us a ton of questions. And as a client of UBS, we have a tremendous referral network. And we had a client recently express some interest in private aviation. So I was going back to our referral network and speaking to a few groups and met Greg throughout that process. And he's with Guardian Jet. And I was very impressed with Greg. I was very impressed with the organization. And since this topic comes up fairly often with us, I figured, why not have Greg on the show? And we can talk all about private aviation. So for those of you out there that are curious about it and want to learn more, I'm hoping that today's conversation will be helpful.
You've come to the right place.
Yep. Yep. So, Greg, let's just start off simple. Like, give us a quick background on you and kind of your role with Guardian Jet. And then we'll talk about kind of what you guys do. And then we'll start to get into some other questions.
Great. Yeah. Excited to be here. Greg Sidor with Guardian Jet. I'm a sales director based in New York City, and my role is really twofold. I'm responsible for going out and identifying new clients and winning business for the firm, as well as managing our existing client relationships. And that's globally. You pick up clients everywhere you go, and like your business, a large part of it comes from referrals and the inherent trust that comes with a referral. And so I find myself traveling just about everywhere to be with our customers and to, you know, form new relationships.
Mm-hmm. And you're in New York, right?
I am.
Yep.
I'm right in Manhattan.
Okay.
Guardian Jet is a whole largest brokerage and aviation consulting firm in the world. We're very proud of that. We've been in business for 25 years. Our headquarters is in small colonial town, Guilford, Connecticut, but we have personnel on four continents. We just opened up a London office. And the value that we bring is really twofold. We're traders, so we'll help you buy and sell aircraft. We'll help you buy and sell charter. And we're also consultants. So we really look to measure all the scenarios that go into private aviation to make sure that you are in the right product and that the financial implications become very clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. The other day when we were talking, you were breaking down some of the different components of the firm. You've got lawyers on staff to help with negotiating contracts. You've got like mechanic specialists to kind of make sure things are going smoothly, which is probably an important thing when you're flying on a private jet.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so I love that. I love the consulting part. I love the fact that you have expertise in contract negotiation, maintenance issues. And so it's a great resource.
Yeah. You know, it's very similar to your business in that the reason someone might choose to partner with UBS is because of all the in-house resources you have. Mm-hmm. That's not to disparage smaller firms that are still successful in their own right, mm-hmm. but they're spread very thin and they can't be an expert in everything.
Right.
And so part of the value that we provide is we've taken those things in-house, attorneys, mm-hmm. AMP, mechanics, contract administration, market researchers, it's all under one roof. Mm-hmm. And it really makes us that one-stop shop. And it allows each of us in our own respective roles to go really deep and be a complete expert.
Right. Right. So let me just kick it off with this. At what point do you think somebody should start entertaining this? Do you have a general sense of that?
From a net worth standpoint or just where they're at in life?
Both.
Sure. Yeah, I find people that give us a call are usually in one of two scenarios. One is they've worked really hard and they want to enjoy their life in a way that's frictionless, mm-hmm. and they want to do what they want to do when they want to do it. Mm-hmm. And private aviation really enables that. Mm-hmm. The other person is trying to maximize their time or grow their business, and they view private aviation as a utility mm-hmm. and something to help them do that. I'd say most 75% of our conversations are the latter, where they view aviation as a business tool. And of course, they're enjoying personal flights to vacation destinations and second homes and what have you. Mm-hmm. But the primary use case is to help them grow their business and be better at what they do. For someone that's looking to understand the experience and the asset class, we typically begin having those conversations probably around a $10 million net worth mm-hmm. is where you might see someone start to experience charter. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the entry level into mm-hmm. private aviation is charter flight. When it comes to owning an aircraft, that really depends on how much you prioritize wanting to have one. Mm-hmm. Like any toy, mm-hmm. a boat, a second or third home, it really just depends what's important to you. Mm-hmm. And owning an aircraft is a serious endeavor. So generally speaking, you're probably north of $25 million in mm-hmm. your net worth before you contemplate ownership.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll get into sort of the different types of ways you can approach private aviation, whether it's debt, card, charter, mm-hmm. owning, and who's the right candidate for what. But one thing that we've talked about is the fact that private aviation is an unregulated industry.
Yep.
So as any unregulated industry, there's a lot of things that go on. So where does that create the most risk or confusion for clients, in your opinion?
It's a question I get every day once I tell people it's unregulated, because we're so accustomed to hearing about the FAA mm-hmm. and most people view aviation as being very regulated. And when it comes to the flying of the airplanes, it is. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to trading or doing charter, that's completely ungoverned. Mm-hmm. And you know, the point you alluded to is that you get a mixed bag of participants in terms of their incentives mm-hmm. and their ethics. Mm-hmm. And we joke at Guardian Jet, even the person down the street cutting your hair needs a license to do that. But all you need to be a jet broker is a phone book and a roll of quarters. And so, especially in the last couple of years where we've seen this become really, really popular, we've witnessed a lot more people come into private aviation to sell charter brokerage or to sell aircraft. And they can make a great living doing just a couple of trades a year. Mm-hmm. But you just see a huge variance in quality of service and really just business ethics mm-hmm. across the board because of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Maybe about a year ago, I was having a conversation with our GBS art specialist, and we were talking about art, and that's another unregulated space. Mm-hmm. And I've got a good friend of mine that's very into art, and I thought it was kind of ironic how the world of art, which is like this creative kind of space, but in this like wild, wild west of unregulated transactions.
Yes.
Right? I mean, a piece of art is only worth as much as somebody else is willing to pay for it. And it's valued at whatever somebody says. There's a lot of subjectivity in there,
right? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. So, which kind of triggers a thought, maybe I need to have him on here to talk about the art market, actually. That would be a good podcast.
It's very similar to private aviation. There's really probably the best art dealer of all time, Larry Gagosian. He now owns the best jet money can buy as a result of the success he had brokering art. And that is, he tells a story of going to a dinner party at someone's house he'd get invited to. And he identified a painting on the wall. Let's say it's a Rembrandt. And the next day he would call up the owner and say, hey, I've got a buyer, you know, or I want to buy that Rembrandt rather for $10 million. And the owner says, okay, you give me a check for $10 million, you can have the painting. And Larry Gagosian would then go to his whole network and say, I've got a Rembrandt for $12 million. Who wants it? And he would find a buyer, and that $2 million spread was his commission. Now, neither party knew what the other party was paying. And he made a fantastic living doing that. The same sort of arbitrage exists in buying and selling jets in that you have people going to owners offering to buy a jet at a certain price. And if they agree, they then go to their entire network and try to find a buyer. And I don't judge how people make their money. You know, everyone's out there hustling. But what it does is it ends up with people who own aircraft that maybe weren't in their best interest. If you way overpaid for something and you go to sell it in 5 years and you find out now you're underwater in your loan or what have you, that can be troublesome. If you buy an aircraft that someone highly recommended to you because the spread they were making was really good, and it turns out it's not the right plane for you or your mission, or it has skeletons, that's going to be troublesome. And so that's kind of what I was getting at with the lack of governance in private aviation, that about 50% of the deals done every year are arbitrage plays, or what are known as back-to-backs.
Yeah. It's kind of like the house flippers that would buy something with a with somebody that's already going to be, that they could sell it to, right? You know, just mark it up. So
I should clarify, because there are people in the space that do inventory plays, and some people in house flipping will take that approach, or art dealing, where they actually buy the asset themselves. And when you do that, you're actually the one assuming the risk.
You're taking risk, for sure.
And so I think you deserve every bit of the upside.
Yeah.
But when you are misleading people on the value of an asset just to play middleman, I think that can get a little precarious.
So you mentioned sort of a new wave of platforms and providers entering the space. How should buyers kind of separate the signal from the noise right now?
It's not easy, because in a day where people are really good at marketing, they're really good at giving the illusion of experience and expertise, it can be hard for someone who's coming into the space who doesn't know any better to figure out what's real and what's faux. What I would encourage them to do is look at the history of the firm. Someone that's been in business for a long time is usually doing something right. That's not to discount those that are trying to disrupt certain parts of the space and be innovators. But if they're doing something the exact same and they're new, I think that warrants you know, some investigating. I would also encourage them to ask for data. Anyone who is good in this business has a ton of data to support the recommendations that they make, much like a financial advisor when they're building your portfolio and they want to make recommendations on a risk-adjusted basis. A broker should be able to do the same thing, and someone who relies entirely on third-party data or just being a good talker is likely not always able to act in your best interest.
That's good perspective there. So let's talk about cost and value. You know, obviously private aviation is not exactly the cheapest thing to do. So let's kind of talk about why it's so expensive. And expensive, I guess, is relative, right? Flying private for somebody worth $10 million, it might be viewed as pretty expensive. Somebody worth $500 million, it's a rounding error. So maybe let's not say it's expensive. Let's just say it's relatively expensive to the majority of the population out there. Let's just get that out of the way. But we work with a ton of founders, and you know, they put their pants on the same way as everyone else, but they've taken some substantial risks and sacrifices in their life to build that company. And they were fortunate enough to have a large exit. And our clients, we love our clients. They're great people, mm-hmm. you know, and they're very charitably minded, giving back. And so I think some folks, particularly some of the politicians that like to put them in a bad light, that maybe they're not the greatest people, but there's always bad apples out there, no matter how much they have in the bank, right?
Of course. So,
but what are people, you know, actually paying for beyond the obvious? You know, you mentioned convenience, you know, obviously, but what else?
Yeah, you know, I think as someone who grew up flying to Disneyland with my parents mm-hmm. and my family, I was lucky to be exposed to commercial aviation even, but at an early age. Mm-hmm. And having been on, man, thousands of airplanes at this point, I've certainly recognized commercial aviation as something that's been commoditized. And I think with that, you tend to forget that this is a metal tube going 500-600 miles an hour, 5 miles or more above the earth. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredible feat of engineering. And to do that successfully, time and time again, requires an incredible amount of support on the back end. And so if you're someone who owns a plane or you want to charter and you fly private, there is a huge support infrastructure involved in making sure that that's a safe and predictable experience for you, starting with the ones in control, the pilots. We've watched pilot salaries climb higher than we could have ever expected. And in my opinion, it's for good reason. These are people that are putting the lives of others in their hands and expected to perform. And history will show that almost 100% of the time they're able to do that. And so I think that that bears a high cost mm-hmm. on the person who wants to fly private. And then you also have everyone behind the scenes that you don't see, the maintenance folks that are turning the wrenches. These are really demanding pieces of machinery and how they're expected to be kept. Mm-hmm. You have the dispatchers and air traffic controllers who are shepherding you to safety mm-hmm. and making sure that you navigate the skies the right way. You have catering, which I think people like to gripe about a lot because it's exorbitantly expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, you have someone who would spend $50,000 to $100,000 on a flight, but it's the catering bill that tends to set them over the edge. You know, a couple hundred dollars for a Caesar salad will yeah. drive anyone off the wall.
Yeah.
But really, it's just a whole team.
How much do you charge for Swedish fish?
Oh, I've seen as much as $50.
No way.
For a pack of Swedish fish.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You're running a monopoly where there's a snack bar in the sky.
It was a fun experience. It was a friend of mine had a place in New Mexico and invited me to join him. Our sons were the same age. And so he's like, just come down to Signature. We'll head over to New Mexico. I was like, okay, cool. Sounds great. So it was my son's like first experience being on a private jet, which not a lot of kids get to do.
No.
And you know, I'm like, Johnny, you better enjoy this because I don't know if you'll ever be able to do this again.
Right.
And, the two memories is the Swedish fish and the iPads on the plane. He was like, this is amazing. I was like, yeah.
But that was the selling point for him?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. This was great.
That's awesome.
We went on a turkey hunt out there and he shot a turkey. It was amazing. We called him in. It was a core memory of, you know, father-son moment.
Oh, yeah.
So
we're lucky to see that every day in our business of people who get to experience private aviation for the very first time.
Yep.
Because to most, it's a mystical thing.
Sure.
But once you do have that experience, it's really unlike anything else.
Yep.
I mean, just it's liberating, it's fun, it's convenient, and you just wish everything in life was that easy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you're talking and you're advising clients, you know, how do you frame the decision? When does it really truly make sense versus just feeling like a luxury?
Yeah, you know, part of what we look to do as consultants is really try to build a business case around the decision to fly private. And I say business case, that could also mean personal. We just want to take our family on a really nice vacation mm-hmm. once a year. And should we be doing this? Mm-hmm. And really what we look to do is to lay out all the trade-offs mm-hmm. because that's like any investment, it's a series of trade-offs. And at what point are you able to rationalize the price you pay for the product or service that you're getting. And with private aviation, because it's unregulated, because it's something most people did not grow up with, mm-hmm. it's hard to benchmark what these costs should be. I mean, they're all high dollars and cents across the board, but it's like you said, it's all relative. And so what we try to help them do is understand exactly what they're getting into and also align them with the right product. There's really three core products within private aviation. There's charter, mm-hmm. which you can think of as a Uber for jets. You know, it's ad hoc missions that you need to take, and mm-hmm. you pay a very large premium for that. You pay 4 to 5, even 6 times the hourly expense that you would pay if you owned the plane.
Wow. Okay. That's a material difference.
It is. But you don't own the asset.
Right.
You don't have to worry about anything. Once you start to fly 25, 50 hours, mm-hmm. you'll entertain a jet card.
Okay.
And that's where you can start to sign up for a degree of consistency. Mm-hmm. So you want to fly on the same type of plane or the same cabin. Mm-hmm. You want to pay plus or minus the same rate. You don't want to be subject to every time you want to fly charter or fly private, you got to field 3 or 4 quotes and go through that whole process.
Right.
You just want consistency. Once you reach 50 hours, call it 50 to 150, you'll probably be looking at fractional. And fractional is when mm-hmm. you sign up to own a small portion of an airplane and you're guaranteed to fly on really that exact model mm-hmm. at a set rate for 50 to 150 hours. Mm-hmm. They come in increments. Once you get to about 150 hours, it really makes sense to start at least having the conversation for whether ownership makes sense. Hmm. Now, the break-even may lie even further than that at 175 or north of 200 hours, depending on the exact model and the mission profile. Mm-hmm. But from a convenience and experience standpoint, that's typically when we encourage our clients or our prospective clients to start looking at the math more closely.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So a few years ago, when I was doing some research in this space, I was asking some clients like their thoughts, and it seemed like 300 hours was a common number that was thrown out back then. Mm-hmm. Has there been some efficiencies in the last few years that has that changed? That was their opinion. I mean,
right.
You're in the business, so just curious.
Sure. It really depends on the model of mm-hmm. aircraft that you're flying in. So the larger aircraft are going to be closer to 300 hours.
Okay.
If you're talking about a big Gulfstream G650,
uh-huh.
it could be even north of that.
Okay.
If you're talking about a light jet, like a Phenom 300 for your runs from New York down to Palm Beach, you know, that...
I've heard those are pretty sweet. I haven't been on one.
They're pretty slick. I'm a fan.
The Phenoms. I think a client of mine is doing a fractional deal. Yeah. I think it might be a Phenom. But
yeah. It's the most prolific light jet ever built.
Okay.
Which is a good thing. You know, some people want a Zig, one other Zag, and they don't want what everyone else has.
Mm-hmm.
In private aviation, you want something that's been tried and true.
Yep.
But, you know, back to the question you asked around break-evens, something that has changed in the last 5 years as we've seen this flood of new entrants mm-hmm. into private aviation is the aircraft are holding their value.
Mm.
Something that historically would depreciate at 7 to 8% a year is not.
Really?
I have clients that are selling airplanes that they bought in 2018 and they're getting almost the exact same price.
Wow.
As what they paid for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because you have more demand than the supply can satisfy.
Got it.
What that does is for the fractional providers, like a NetJets, for example, they fly their airplanes close to 1,000 hours a year.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a Latitude, for example. It's a very popular mid-sized jet. They'll fly their Latitudes close to 1,000 hours a year. Someone who owns one outright will fly it 200 or 250.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you own part of a fractional share, the rate of depreciation on it is 4 times faster than if you owned the airplane outright.
Okay.
because when you get into a fractional share, you commit to 5 years. I'm going to own 1/16th of an airplane for 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, I'm going to sell it either back to NetJets or to someone else. NetJets dictates what that price is. And what we're seeing now is the airplane will lose close to 50% of its value if you go fractional. Whereas if you own it, we're not seeing the planes lose any value. And so when you factor in residual value into the equation, it slides the goalposts downstream to be closer to 150 to 250 hours versus north of 300.
Got it. So the fractionals, from a fractional standpoint, because I know, you know, people do the fractional and then they'll lease it back to be used and to generate some income, right? Is the spirit of that, like, I'm sure this differs from different types of aircraft or whatever, but does that make up for some of the depreciation that happens?
It's always a tricky balance that we help our clients try to measure. If I own an airplane and I'm only going to fly it 150 hours, well, should I charter it out to help offset some of my fixed costs?
Right.
And if I do, how much should I charter it out?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're putting more time on the airplane, you're depreciating it faster, you're accelerating your maintenance cycles. So you got to turn more wrenches to keep this thing flying. And there is a balance. Typically, we see that the most two pilots could fly an aircraft or is about 250 hours a year. Maybe you push 300, but you'll probably hear that they're tired.
Yeah.
So once you get over 300 hours, now you got to hire a third pilot. And that changes the math. And so when we're helping people figure out, I want to charter my aircraft out, how much should I do it? It's really a calculus of figuring out what are you getting to, to give that up? And are you going to restrict the access you have to your own airplane if you're trying to make it available to the charter market?
So we talked about like fractional versus ownership. Let's go from charter to fractional. What's the, just give me a little bit of color on that.
Sure. So I think when you get around 50 hours, that's sort of the entry level into fractional. They call it 1/16th of an airplane or 50 hours of usage that you get for the year. And the fractional providers have done an incredible job. I mean, they are logistics masters because they have a very high NPS. People that use fractionals generally love the experience.
NPS.
Net Promoter Score.
Okay.
Yep. That's a marketing acronym I learned in college, but haven't used it
much. In case the audience doesn't know that, just make sure. I live in the world of acronyms, so I'm always having to explain it because it just, you know, we talk about it, it's just our everyday language.
You and me both.
So, yeah.
So the fractionals are just fantastic, and they allow you to take advantage of depreciation because unlike charter, you now own a small sliver of an airplane, and and there are tax benefits that you can get from that. Fractional does a fantastic job at giving people a very consistent experience. However, where it differs from ownership is when you buy into 1/16th or 1/8th of a plane, it's very unlikely that you'll ever fly on the airplane that you bought a piece of because these fractional fleets are hundreds and hundreds of airplanes.
Okay.
And they're in the game of just trying to figure out the right ways to move them so that you can have access when you want and it can be economic for their model. What that means is when you get on an airplane, yes, it's the same model that you bought a piece of, but it's not your aircraft. And so there are just differences between when you get on a plane and it has the snacks that you like in the fridge and your blanket and your iPads versus getting on something that's been a little bit more standardized.
Right. Okay. So fractional. So that's not a fractional ownership on a specific plane. It's a fractional ownership in a class of planes, I guess.
It's actually a specific plane.
Okay.
It's sold to you
as... Because I was thinking, like, if you have 15 other people using that plane, that's going to be a kind of a mess trying to get your... Everybody's going to want to be going on for a Christmas vacation or Thanksgiving or spring break. So, like, coordinating that
That's it.
Yeah.
So what these fractional providers have done well is they have incredible scale, which is why it's very hard for anyone to get into the fractional game.
Okay.
Because to do it well, you need scale.
Scale.
And basically, to your point, when you buy a 16th of an airplane or a portion of an airplane and the other 15 owners want to use it, well, the fractional providers have hundreds of them. And that's how they enable you to all have access on the same days. They might flex you up into a bigger model. And there are some sort of rules of engagement with regards to how far in advance you need to book or blackout dates where you're not guaranteed availability because everyone wants to travel around the holidays.
Right.
But generally speaking, you will always have access when you call them.
Okay. So from a tax standpoint, we're not in the business of giving tax advice, by the way, but...
No, we are not.
What have you seen as far as depreciation and anything else that's worth mentioning?
It has been...
What are the questions that people should ask their accountants, I guess? Maybe it was a better question.
Right. I mean, for clients like yours that are founders in many cases and have had huge liquidity events, this is a really compelling tax play for them to not only get an aircraft or a portion of one, but be able to offset their taxable income with that purchase or that investment. And so really the idea behind bonus depreciation is that you can take 100% depreciation of this asset you just bought in the very first year.
Okay.
And we've seen a lot of people call into Guardian Jet because they made a lot of money.
Right.
And they're trying to offset some of that. Now, what you should be weary of is there are very strict regulations in place for how you need to use the aircraft and whether it's categorized as personal or business and what percent is going to yield what offsets. That is all very, very defined. And so the notion of I'm just going to buy this jet and I'll fly it to play golf with my buddies is not going to make you eligible for those offsets. This needs to be used in a business capacity.
Okay.
Yep.
Gotcha. So that's interesting. When we think about planning around an exit, yeah, I mentioned a lot of our clients are charitably minded. So in the year of that big exit, oftentimes that's when we want to accelerate several years worth of giving into a year, you know, by using tools, either a private foundation or most people use a donor advised fund where you can basically overfund it and get that deduction in the year that you had the big asset inflow, right? So it sounds like if somebody's kind of toying around with something like this, that should be another planning component. It's like, okay, I'm tracking to sell the business. I think I'm going to make a big chunk of money. I'd like to start thinking about private aviation. How often am I going to be using it? Does it make sense to potentially do fractional or ownership? And how can that impact my taxes?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's a good point.
You know, we're not tax experts, but we're we know enough to be dangerous. And so we'll sort of, we'll help clients measure this over a 5 or 10 year life cycle. If I am to maintain using this aircraft at least 50% for business purposes, how is this going to impact my overall expenses versus, you know what, I'm a founder, I sold my business, I'm now retired and I want to buy an airplane. I can't take advantage of bonus depreciation because I've been retired for 5 years. I don't have an active income.
Right.
Does this still make sense? And that's something we can walk you through.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. You mentioned approaching aviation kind of like, well, it's an asset. How should clients think about this alongside the rest of their portfolio?
I think it really depends on whether you want to use the asset to grow your business or you want to view it as a lifestyle expense. Lifestyle expense is totally discretionary.
Consumption.
Exactly.
Pure consumption. Yep.
So that really is up to the individual. Now we can try to help benchmark you against what your peers might be viewing as a reasonable allocation to private aviation. That's not really our swim lane, but we are exposed to enough of it where we can kind of give you a feel for what others are doing. If you're using it to grow your business, the justifications become really, really apparent when you start to measure the time savings over the course of a year and your ability to perform better mm-hmm. because of all the benefits that come with private aviation. I mean, you're rested, you inherently have less stress because you're on your own watch, mm-hmm. not someone else's, and you can continue to be productive mm-hmm. during the time of travel. I mean, a lot of these aircraft are outfitted with conference tables for you to be able to hold meetings. And now the biggest hype in, I wouldn't even call it hype, the biggest attraction in private aviation is Starlink mm-hmm. because it's given people the ability to maintain absolute continuity in mm-hmm. their life and remain connected at mm-hmm. any point in their journey. Mm-hmm. And so when we can start to measure the time that you get back and you can ascribe a value to that time, all of a sudden private aviation, when it comes to business, is maybe a lot less expensive than mm-hmm. people originally thought.
It's a pretty cool remote working setup, you know?
The coolest one I ever saw. Start
by Starlink on my like adventure trailer, you know? Like I'm sitting in a park and, you know, right. knock out some work. I didn't think about it.
The coolest on the jet. Setup I saw was a really well-known trader, runs a very successful hedge fund, and he had not one, but four different connection products on his plane. So he basically four different types of Wi-Fi on his plane, and he had the whole three monitors set up,
yep.
the whole rig in the back of the airplane, because if he wanted to place a trade, there was yep. nothing that was going to stop him.
Damn, that's awesome. So let's talk about breaking down sort of a 10-year life cycle cost. You know, what are the biggest hidden drivers that people underestimate?
So when we look at...
Besides the Swedish fish.
And that'll get you. Those things sneak up on you. When we look
Caesar
at...
Caesar salad and a Swedish fish, $250.
Yeah. That's a real line item in catering.
Yeah.
We look at life cycle costs as buy, fly, sell. And that's kind of the mm-hmm. layman's way to break down what that entails, but buying an aircraft, and that has a material expense to it between your broker, your aviation attorney, perhaps your origination fees if you're going to be borrowing money, your tax expert. I mean, you could be in the ballpark of between $250,000 and $500,000 just to buy an aircraft. That's on the front end. And you also want to make sure that you're getting into it at a great market value. Mm-hmm. If you overpay considerably for the aircraft now, it's really going to hurt you in your exit. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you want a good trader to be able to basically beat the market and get you in at a good price before it's common knowledge, you know, what the aircraft is actually worth. Mm-hmm. Then you get to fly. That's the middle of the life cycle cost. And that includes everything from the crew that you need to employ. We typically see most aircraft owners with two full-time pilots and maybe a full-time or part-time mechanic. They use oftentimes what's called a management company, which is exactly what it sounds like, someone to look after the aircraft mm-hmm. when you're not on it, and someone who can help facilitate the scheduling and logistics that go into, hey, I just want to show up and fly mm-hmm. when I want. You've got overhead like hangars. I had a post on my Twitter or X the other week about hangar space in Teterboro outside New York City now costing more per square foot than a New York City penthouse.
Okay.
And so in that particular area of the country, you're looking at about $75,000 a month to park your Gulfstream G650.
Uh-huh. What's the value of that Gulfstream 650?
It's probably about $50 million.
Okay.
So again, all relative.
Yeah, all relative, yep.
But still, something that needs to be accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
We look at how the airplane's going to be used. So are you flying more or less than the fleet average? You know, if you're flying the wings off this plane, again, that's really going to hurt the residual value. You have things like engine programs, which are basically insurance policies for the engines mm-hmm. where the lion's share of the value of an aircraft is held. Mm. If you look at an airplane, you know, probably 25, if not more, percent of its value is just in the engines.
Wow, okay.
So those need to be thoughtfully cared for and looked after.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the exit, so the sell part at the end of the 10-year life cycle. And again, fees associated with that. There are ways to time it around big maintenance events. Probably the most expensive part of owning an airplane are the big maintenance events. They tend to happen, you know, you have annual check-ins and tune-ups, but every 8 years are the big ones. They can run seven figures and you'll be down for 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
Having your plane worked on. Mm-hmm. And so we try to be really thoughtful about the exit strategy. Do you want to get out of the aircraft before that big maintenance event? Mm. Or do you want to go through it and now you're selling a turnkey aircraft and you can charge a premium for that?
Mm. So be mindful of if you're buying the aircraft in year seven, you're going to have a bit of a surprise next year.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the biggest gotchas when it comes to buying is, you know, that's where all the exposure lies is in the maintenance and the history of the airplane. Like wine, there are good vintages and bad.
Mm-hmm.
There are regions of the world or the country where you prefer to buy your wine from or see it's lived.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exact same thing with airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really want to have a very clear understanding of the costs before you buy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's very helpful there. We were kind of talking about what are some of the biggest mistakes you see first-time buyers or users make. So I think just you walking through all of that, it's just not knowing what they're getting into.
Right.
You know, and just having, it's just the value again of having a team to kind of help guide you. And I mean, that's, we're like a broken record with founders. It's like you get one shot at the big exit.
Right.
And it's more than likely the biggest financial event of your life. So you got to make sure you're working with a team that kind of thinks about this all the time. Right.
Right.
Because there's just, you just don't know what you don't know. So you recently launched Capstone. What gap were you seeing in the charter market that led you to kind of build something new here?
Well, for 25 years, we were in the trading business and consulting business. And for one, we identified an opportunity to get in earlier in the customer journey and start a relationship as early as possible and then become their advisor for life.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly when someone's getting into private aviation for the first time, it's often through charter.
Mm-hmm.
What we identified in the market as an opportunity was huge margin that charter brokers were making, basically trying to exploit the lack of efficiency within the market.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about efficient markets, buyers and sellers have equal access to information, and that drives efficient pricing. That doesn't exist with private aviation. And so it's really hard to understand the spread that someone is making to help you book a charter trip. And part of our philosophy with Capstone is a cost plus model. And so it's very clear and explicit, the commission that we'll be making on each of these trades.
Mm-hmm.
And we just try to give you absolute clarity around what exactly you're buying and where your dollars are going.
Mm-hmm.
Another piece of the opportunity we identified was huge variance in quality control with charter. You have operators who look after their own aircraft. They have certain maintenance standards and care standards that they apply to all the planes in their fleet. We vet operators to find the fleets where they have the highest safety standards. And those are the planes that we charter for our clients versus going out there and trying to find a deal. I'll give you an example. We've been tracking airplanes for decades, and so we understand the background of these aircraft. There's a lot more than what meets the eye. So a charter broker may come to you and give you a screaming deal on a Challenger flight. Little do you know, that airplane had two bird strikes last year, and it hasn't been flying quite the same since.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on paper, you're seeing a beautiful interior and the model that you want, but you don't get the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do a lot of auditing on your behalf, and mm-hmm. we really look to give you absolute transparency in what you're paying for.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a valuable service there. Let's wrap it up here. We've been going about 45 minutes. And so thank you for your time, Greg, and thank you for coming to Austin. I'm sorry that today is such a rainy day for you, but hopefully we'll get a little sunshine this weekend for you.
I hope so too. It's been a perfect day to hunker down and podcast, so that's cool with me.
That's right. So if someone's listening today and is spending, say, a couple hundred $100,000 to $500,000 a year on private flights? You know, what should they be doing differently or more thoughtfully?
Well, I think they should first off have someone that they really trust that they're working with. A lot of times the approach with charter is to reach out to four or five brokers and kind of run your own RFP process, request for proposal, mm-hmm. and then go with the cheapest option. And that can be effective for some, but it's certainly in the experiences that I've seen leads to a lack of consistency mm-hmm. in the experience. And so I would encourage someone getting into private aviation or who has a pretty modest footprint in it and is looking to grow that to find someone that can help them measure exactly what they're getting into. Mm-hmm. And you don't want an order taker. You want someone that can really help guide you mm-hmm. and think long term about what's in your best interest. Mm-hmm. For example, maybe there's a certain type of aircraft that you think you like as a principal, but is really not great for your mission. Either it's overkill or it's got a dropped aisle floor and your dog's not going to like that. Mm-hmm. There's so much nuance to the experience, and a good advisor will help you understand where you can be more right-sized mm-hmm. and more efficient to the extent that you want to be. Some people just yeah. want what they want, and that's great.
Yeah.
But if you want to be very thoughtful in how you start getting into this and how you spend your money, you want someone who can really help highlight the differences across everything that's out there.
Awesome. Okay, last question. Stack rank your three favorite jets.
Oh, man.
Number three, two, and one.
You know, we're supposed to be unbiased over here on the brokerage side because we buy a lot of new airplanes from the OEMs for uh-huh. our clients. Uh-huh. And so we're kind of buddies with everybody.
Okay. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Man, yeah, I might table that one. It's got to be a super mid is uh-huh. my favorite class.
Okay. So, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super mid.
Super mid will get you anywhere domestically without stopping. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I think, probably the most popular class of aircraft because it's big enough to be comfortable for you and 6 to 8 people. Mm-hmm. It's very efficient for getting you anywhere in the country. And from a brokerage standpoint, they trade like hotcakes. Mm-hmm. And you can get in and out of one. It's basically liquid.
Okay.
So okay. We like that.
Yeah, that's nice.
We don't want something that's going to sit on the market for 2 years that nobody has fun with that.
Yeah.
So super mid.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Greg, again, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with me today and learning more about the private aviation space. I'm excited to push this out to everybody. I think it's going to be very helpful. I kind of mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, for those of you that are still listening, UBS has a referral network and Guardian Jet is one of the trusted providers in this space and get some benefits as being a client of ours, which is nice.
We very much enjoy the relationship. We appreciate you bringing us to the table and putting bread on our table. So thank you. And thanks so much for having me today. This was fun.
Very good. For those of you out there that have an interest in exploring this space, we'd be happy to make the connection. You can just shoot us an email at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And with that, we'll let you go. Be safe, be well. And until next time, take care. Thank you for tuning in to Lightning in a Bottle. It's been a pleasure bringing you today's insights from the brightest minds in business. To stay updated with relevant content, exclusive events, and our latest podcast episodes, send us a note to atxwealthpartners.com. Until next time, keep capturing the lightning of innovation and turning it into success. I'm Josh Pottinger, wishing you a productive and prosperous week ahead. And don't forget, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.